traditional belief is that Job is the key book in the Bible, Virgil said. The question of why God allows evil to exist. Furling forward, intent on the point. Job talks of the world as it is. Revelation tells us what's coming. I'm not entirely of this world, Mr. Flowers. Not entirely. Some of this world has been burned out of me. Virgil said, We're all entirely of this world, Reverend. You're just like anybody else, going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it. Fur was smiling at him, then shook his head once and said to Trevor, Show Mr. Flowers to the door, and give him one of our booklets about the niggers. On the way back to town, Virgil's cell phone rang. He glanced at the dashboard, 1 minute after two. Williamson from the newspaper. He flipped the phone open and said, Yes? Todd Williamson, you had some news for me? This comes from the sky, from nowhere. You can get confirmation of the rumor from a Mrs. Margaret Lehman or her daughter Jessie. Jessie, we're being told, is the natural daughter of Bill Judd Sr. After a moment of silence, Williamson said, Fuck me with a barbed wire fence, which Virgil thought was pretty prairie-like of him. Chapter 6 When he'd gotten off the phone with Williamson, Virgil punched up Stryker's cell phone number, thought about it for a moment, then tapped it. Stryker came up 5 seconds later. From the background rush, Virgil could tell that he was in his truck. Did you talk to the Laymans? Virgil asked. Yeah, sex and money on the low plains, Stryker said. They're telling the truth. They've talked to an attorney over in Worthington, and they're going to petition the district court for a part in the probate process. Margaret says Jesse will stand up to a DNA test. Where are you at now? Virgil asked. Heading back to the office. Got your heart in your mouth? I wish I hadn't told you about that, Stryker said. You're going to spread it all over town. On the other hand, I've got Joni to hold over your head. Listen, I'm just coming up to I-90 after talking to Fur. Not much to report there. So tell me how to find the Laymans, and give me their phone number. George Fur's readiness to swear on the Bible, and in a comprehensive way, had impressed Virgil. Fur had the stink of fanaticism about him, and fanatics, whatever else you might say about him, didn't take the word lightly. Interesting, though, that he denied knowing the Gleasons. That was something that could be falsified. The town of Roche once had a bar and a combination grocery gas station. Now it had two empty and unsaleable old commercial buildings slowly sinking back into the earth, and a dozen houses, some neatly kept, some not. Flower gardens here, untrimmed lawns there, grape arbors and old wire fences, rusting swing sets, and a brand new treehouse, a collapsed chicken house, abandoned farm equipment from the first half of the 20th century, all gathered on the banks of the Billy Cooley, a seasonal creek that ran down to the Stark River. A white dog with floppy ears was sitting in the middle of the street when Virgil got there, 20 minutes after talking to Stryker. The dog examined the front of Virgil's truck, realized that it didn't belong to anybody in town, and so ambled off to the side, keeping an eye out for trouble. The layman's house was on the left side of the main street, a white clapboard story and a half with a brooding dark roof and a brick chimney at one end, a narrow front porch with a white-painted railing. Orange earthenware pots of geranium sat on the railing, and hollyhocks grew next to the steps. A huge cottonwood stood in back, towering over two smaller apple trees. A side yard was occupied by a vegetable garden, neatly laid out, tilled and weeded. The sweet corn leaves were showing brown edges, the corn silk brown, the ears ready to eat. Four rows of potato plants marched along at 18-inch intervals, and cucumber and squash vines sprawled around the corn. The whole thing was edged with marigolds, which Virgil thought were intended to ward off some kind of rootworm. In any case, his parents still did the same thing, grew an annual vegetable garden and edged it with marigolds. Virgil parked and got out, and the white dog barked at him, but only once, and then tentatively wagged his tail. Virgil grinned at him, a watchdog but not an armed response dog. At the house, a blonde woman came out on the porch. She was dressed for an office in black slacks and a white blouse. She said, "You're Mr. Flowers." Mother and daughter didn't look much alike. Margaret, the woman who'd met him on the porch, was in her mid-50s, Virgil thought, and dressed from Target or Penny's, standard office wear. She was about 5'6", a bit too heavy, and busty, with short, heavily frosted hair, plastic-rimmed glasses, and the lined face of a woman who'd been long out in the wind. She'd been pretty, still was, for her age. Her daughter was almost her opposite, long dark hair, eyes that were almost black, slender, with high cheekbones and a square chin. She was wearing jeans, cowboy boots, and a plain white T-shirt. She had pierced ears and was wearing silver crescent moon earrings. She was waiting in the living room, standing next to an old upright piano. An electric guitar was propped next to it, with a practice amp. The window ledges were lined with pots of African violets. Virgil stood in the living room for a moment, blinking in the dim light, and Jesse asked, "Ooh, do you like to rock and roll?" "I do," he said. He recognized her. She'd been at Bill Judd Sr.'s house the night of the fire. She'd had a beer can in her hand. Jesse to her mother. "He looks like a surfer dude, doesn't he?" "He's a police officer," her mother said dryly. "You probably should remember that." "Police officers gotta fuck," Jesse said, flopping back on a worn couch, smiling up at him. "If they didn't, where'd we get all those goobers who go to monster truck rallies?" "Jesse," her mother said. "Thank you," Virgil said. Jesse teased her mother with the F-word, and her mother pretended to be shocked, but wasn't. It looked like an old mother-daughter game. "If I ever have any little goobers, I'll name one of them Jesse." She laughed and said, "Want a Pepsi?" "No thanks, I just want to chat," Virgil said. "Might as well. The newspaper just called, and every single soul from Fairmont to Sioux Falls will know about it tomorrow morning." Her mother had been at work when the Judd Mansion burned down, and had no idea where she'd been when the Gleasons were killed. Jesse had been on her way to a bar in Bluestem, and saw the fire on the ridge, and the trucks pulling out of the bar's parking lot, heading up the hill. "That good enough?" Jesse asked. "If you hadn't been to the bar, where'd you get that beer? The one you had at the parking lot?" She tipped her head toward the kitchen. "Out of the refrigerator." "So you just went up to the fire to look at it?" "Of course," she said. "What do you think? You ever lived in a small town?" "I have, and I know what you mean," he said. "These people who got killed, the Gleasons and Judd, they were the same age, and friendly at least," Virgil said, turning to Margaret. "I'm wondering if there's something way back that's only coming out now. Something that really pissed somebody off 30 or 40 years ago and winds up in these murders." Jesse looked at her mother, and Margaret shrugged. "I had a pretty hot affair with Bill Judd, but the only thing I came out of it with was that girl." She nodded at Jesse. "I loved her from day one. For the first 18 years, Bill sent me a check every month to cover her upbringing, so I don't have any complaints that way either." "Don't have any complaints that he didn't marry you?"
"He never asked, which would have been polite, but I wouldn't have done it anyway," Margaret said. "He could be a good time, but he was 25 years older than me, and he could be a mean jerk. I mean really violent, beat-your-face-in mean."
"How long did you date him?"
"Oh, a year or so. But it wasn't exclusive, on his part. He'd screw anything he could get his hands on."
She smiled, then tilted her head and asked, "Have you talked to his sister-in-law? She might be able to tell you about those days."
"I didn't know about a sister-in-law. What's her name?"
"Betsy Carlson," Margaret said. "Sister to his wife. She's been in a rest home over in Sioux Falls for, gosh, 25 or 30 years now. I think Bill was paying for that, too."
Virgil said, "You sort of linked screwing with his sister-in-law. Was there something going on there?"
"Yeah." She said it flatly, her voice like flat rocks smacking together.
"Before his wife died or after?" Virgil asked.
"If you want my opinion, I'd say before he married his wife, during, and after," Margaret said.
"How'd his wife die?"
"Heart attack," she said.
32 years old.
Sure it was a heart attack?
You said he was beat your face in mean. This was before the thing with Jerusalem artichokes, and before everybody hated him, so there wasn't that mean talk you would have heard later. All the official stuff said it was a myocardial infarction, so I guess that's what it was.
Huh,
Virgil said, and he thought Russell Gleason was the coroner. He turned back to Jesse. How long have you known that Bill Judd was your father? Her tongue peeked out, and she rubbed it on her upper lip, thinking.
For sure, since the day after the fire. Mom sat me down and told me. But I thought he might be, from one thing or another that she said over the years. I knew it was somebody from around here.
She'd start talking about being responsible even when you're having fun, and his name came up a couple of times. And I kind of look like a Judd.
So you've sort of known for a while.
Yeah, but I didn't really care, she said. Everybody said he was a jerk, and he looked like a jerk, and his son was a jerk, so why would I care? I wouldn't have even thought about it when he died if Mom hadn't said that I should be practical.
You mean get a chunk of the estate, Virgil said.
That's what it comes down to, Jesse said and smiled.
Do you know George Furr?
Know who he is, never met him, Jesse said. Margaret shook her head.
Tell me, Virgil said to Margaret, what was it like back then, when Judd was on the loose? There are all these rumors.
Judd had slept with an untold number of local women, Margaret said. Untold being the literal word, since nobody knew how many, but many. He liked to go three at a time when he could find the girls willing to do it. The word was, he liked to do one of the girls, then watch them do each other, and then he could get it up to do another one. And around and around.
Mom,
Jesse said, maybe really shocked.
Margaret shrugged.
That's the way it was, honey. I didn't get involved in any groups. I was strictly one-on-one. But you know, on the right night, if I'd had a couple of drinks, might have gone for a roll with a couple of the girls. I mean, we were rock and rollers. Everything was getting loose. The Stones, the Beatles, the War, smoking dope. She reached out toward his chest and the Stones t-shirt. We old people lived that t-shirt.
Were there any other guys involved? Virgil asked.
Never heard of any, but there could have been, I guess, she said.
Is that relevant?
Somebody had to drag old man Judd down to his basement to kill him, Virgil said. His eyelids dropped and he looked Jesse over.
Seems more like to be male than female. Could have been a strong woman.
Margaret said to Jesse, see, looks like a surfer, thinks like a cop.
Do you know any other of the local women? Virgil asked.
One was Betsy Carlson. I know two more, but I think I'll only tell you one. Michelle Garber, who lives in Worthington now. She's in the book.
Virgil wrote the name in his notebook.
Why won't you tell me the other?
Because she's got a happy marriage and I don't want to mess it up.
And it would, if it got out, Margaret said.
What if her husband found out, and he's the killer? Virgil asked.
He isn't, Margaret said coolly. I know for sure that he doesn't know. And I won't tell who it is.
Jessie's mouth hung open for a moment, and then she said to her mother, you gotta be kidding me.
Virgil to Jessie, you know who it is?
I just guessed, she said.
You shush, Margaret said.
If it turns out to be that man, I'll do my best to put you two in jail, Virgil said.
His voice had gone cool, and Jesse sat back.
You gotta understand that.
It's not him, Margaret said.
Jesse bobbed her head and said, it really isn't.
When Margaret suggested there had been a lot of local women, Virgil wondered, did that also imply non-local women?
There were professionals from Minneapolis, Margaret said. That was the rumor. Supposedly, one of the local women came down with something that we wouldn't get around here. Supposedly, it came from a woman he got at a striptease place up in Minneapolis, on Hennepin Avenue.
Virgil thought, she'd need a doctor, like Gleason.
Was this Garber who came down with it?
He looked back in his notebook. Michelle Garber? No. I don't know who it was, if there was anybody, just a rumor. Michelle might know, though. She spent more time with Bill than I did, and she was quite a bit wilder than I was. She might be able to give you more names, group names. Virgil tapped his notebook against his chin, looking at Margaret, and said, "Sounds like Judd was out of control." If you were ever going to look for one sentence for Bill Judd's tombstone, "out of control" might be it, she said. He never had enough money, enough land, enough power, enough women. He was an animal. He was my daddy, Jesse said thoughtfully. Well, there's something to be said for animals, Margaret said. He certainly could get me going, for a while anyway. When they were done, Margaret excused herself, said she had to run off to the bathroom. Jesse took him out the front door, and they looked at the dog on the street, and Jesse said, "That's righteous." And then she touched him on the chest, on the old stone shirt, and asked, "You really like music?" "Yes, I do," Virgil said. "I'm a damn good dancer, too." "Who do you like?" "You know, some old, some new. Kind of like alternative. Used to listen to some rap, but it got pretty commercial." "Music's the only thing that ever moved me, aside from sex," she said. She whistled sharply, and Righteous heaved himself to his feet and started toward them. "I wish Jimmy Stryker liked that stuff. He wants me so bad that he gets little drops of blood on his forehead every time we talk. But he's so straight. He listens to old funky country. Bo Cephas, Pre-Cephas, and Re-Cephas, or whatever they call them. He's a good guy, Jim is. And I don't think you'd be bored." Virgil gave her a small smile. "You might be a little too busy for the first 10 years or so to think much about his music." "Huh." The dog came up and sat on the porch step, and Jesse scratched him on the top of the head between the floppy ears. "Maybe I'll give him a try. Or maybe not, now that I'm a rich woman." "You ain't rich yet, honey," Virgil said. "Even if you do get rich, it'll be a while before it happens. Might as well fill up the space with Jimmy. You could find out something good." "I already know something bad, though," she said. "Yeah?" "One time, this was 5 or 6 years ago, before he was sheriff, he was a deputy. There was a fight down at Bad Boys, and he came to break it up. One of the guys in the fight gave him a shove, a little punch maybe. And Jim, I mean, he just beat the hell out of this guy. I mean, beat the hell out of him. Cuffed him, dragged him out to the patrol wagon, banged his head off the ground, banged his head into the car. He was way, way rough." "Two things," Virgil said, not smiling. "Cops hate to get hit, especially in a crowd of drunks. You can get mobbed if you don't move fast. You get punched, you take the guy down, put him on the floor, put your hand on your gun butt, look at faces in the crowd like you're looking for somebody to shoot. Face him down right then. Sober him up." "Still, what was the second thing? You said there were two." "Maybe he was showing off for somebody in the crowd," Virgil said. "Some guys think the tough stuff impresses women. Hope it does." She nodded. "I've seen that. Just didn't think about it with Jim." Thought about it a second, then said, "It did make me a little hot." Virgil got Judd Jr.'s office on the phone as he drove back to I-90, and the woman who answered said Judd was just going out the door and she'd try to catch him. Judd came up a minute later. "What?" "You have an aunt in a nursing home in Sioux Falls," Virgil said. "I'm out that way. I thought I'd stop and see her. Can you tell me which one it is?" "Why do you want to see her?" Judd asked. "Well, we've had 3 murders. All 3 people were elderly. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe the cause isn't back years ago," Virgil said. "So I'm talking to people who knew your father and the Gleasons back when." Judd seemed to think a minute, then said grudgingly, "That's an idea. It's the Grunewald Rest Home. It's actually north of Sioux Falls, north of I-90. Virgil memorized the instructions when he'd gotten off the phone, decided the news of Jesse Lehman's claim hadn't yet gotten to Judd. He'd been entirely too calm and matter-of-fact. He wondered if Williamson, working on borrowed time now, was planning to break it on him like a rotten egg, let him wander around, unknowing, until somebody said, "Bill..." The Grunewald Rest Home sat on one of two nearly identical hills a mile north of I-90, 10 miles west of the Minnesota line, with a county highway running through the groove between the two hills. Both hills were nicely wooded, with broad lawns beneath the trees. The one on the right showed the Grunewald, a wide brick box, 3 stories tall, with white trim. The one on the left showed neat rows of white stone. A cemetery. Nice, Virgil thought. The Grunewald residents could look out the windows every day and see their future. Virgil pulled into a visitor slot in front of the home and walked inside. The Grunewald was run like a hospital or a hotel, with a front reception desk and lobby with soft chairs. A tiny gift niche was built to one side of the reception desk and was stocked with candy, soft drinks, women's and family magazines, and ice cream. A tall black woman in Somali dress was working behind the desk. She nodded at Virgil, and he took out his ID, showed it to her, and asked to see Betsy Carlson. The woman's eyebrows went up, and she said, "She doesn't have many visitors. You'll have to ask Dr. Burke." Burke was a busy, bald man in a corner office down the hall from the desk. He listened to Virgil's story and then shrugged and said, "Sure, go ahead." "What kind of shape is she in?" "She is damaged. Hard to tell why. Could be genetics, bad wiring, or she might have taken some drugs and had a bad reaction, or even environmental poisoning. She grew up on a farm. Lots of bad chemicals on a farm when she grew up. They used to spray DDT around like it was rainwater. So it's hard to know. She's not crazy. She just goes away. Her memories are screwed up, but she has a lot of them. She's never been active, and she's gotten less active, so her legs don't work very well anymore. So, she is what she is." On that note, Burke called back to the Somali woman at the front desk, told her to get somebody to escort Virgil into the home, smiled, and wished Virgil good luck. Virgil's escort was a middle-aged but still apple-cheeked nurse, carrying a plastic garbage bag full of something Virgil didn't ask about. They went through a set of locked doors, and Virgil asked, "Everybody's locked in?" "No. We have a locked area for Alzheimer's victims, because they tend to wander, and the younger ones can be pretty aggressive. But those doors," she jabbed a thumb back over her shoulder at the doors they'd just come through, "they're only locked one way, to keep people out. Years ago, before we started locking the doors, we had a very nice man as a visitor. He'd visit every couple of days. It turns out he was molesting some of our residents." "Nice guy." "When we started to suspect something was going on, we set up some video cameras and caught him at it." She smiled cheerfully at Virgil. "A couple of our Alzheimer's orderlies escorted him to the lobby so the police could pick him up. He resisted on the way, tried to fight, and was somewhat beaten up before they got him to the lobby. He won't come back here, even when he gets out of prison." "Hate it when they resist," Virgil said. "It's a bad idea," she agreed. The nurse spotted Betsy Carlson in a chair facing a television that was showing a man chopping up onions and cabbage with the world's sharpest knives, guaranteed not to get dull. "There she is," the nurse said. She put a hand on Virgil's sleeve and said, "She can be a little difficult, so it's best to be sweet with her. If you push too hard, she gets stubborn." Dr. Burke said her memory is messed up. "Yes, but the memories that go back, those generally tend to be better. She can't remember what day it is, but she can tell you what she was doing in 1962, and she likes telling you. Another thing, though, is that she sometimes has hallucinations. She sees bugs in her food." "And there aren't any?" "Please. Not only bugs, she sees people. She sees people's faces in the knots in wood. We're scared to death that someday she's going to see the Virgin Mary in a rust stain, and we'll wind up with 10,000 pilgrims on the lawn." She paused and then said, "She'll be happy to see you, but she'll forget your name all the time and ask for it." Betsy Carlson was tucked into her chair with an afghan. She was the ruin of a beautiful woman, with high cheekbones, an elegant oval face, and what must have been fine, delicate skin, now furrowed with thousands of tiny wrinkles. Her hair was cut short, and her hazel eyes were glassy and placid. She smiled reflexively when Virgil pulled up next to her. The nurse said, "Betsy, you have a visitor." She stared at Virgil for a moment, uncomprehending, then frowned and asked,
"Who are you?"
"Virgil Flowers. I'm a police officer from Minnesota."
"I haven't done anything," she said. "I've been here."
"We know," Virgil said. The nurse nodded at him and drifted away with her garbage bag. "I need to talk to you about Bluestem and some things that have been going on there."
"Bluestem, founded in 1886 by the Chicago and Northwestern Railway. My great-grandfather was among the first settlers, Amos Carlson. His father fought the Indians in the Great Uprising. My father owned 640 acres in Stafford Township, the best land in Stark County. He was killed in an automobile accident on County 16 in a blizzard. His skull was crushed. I was born the very next day. My mama always said that I was a special child, God's gift. There was a death in the family, and then new life, all at the same time. What did you say your name was again?"
Virgil reintroduced himself, and then began pulling out memories of Bluestem and Bill Judd and her sister the days after her sister's heart attack. She remembered the day of the heart attack.
"My sister drank too much, and then she'd fight with Bill. You could hear them screaming all over the house, usually about money. He had it, but he hated to spend it. The day she had the heart attack, she was drinking, but she wasn't fighting. She started feeling sick in the morning and thought maybe she'd drunk too much the night before. Anyway, she decided to move some furniture around in the living room, and we were dragging couches here and chairs over there and pushing this old upright piano around, and we were just about done when she cries out, 'Lord Almighty!' and she falls down. I ask her what's wrong, and she says, 'I hurt so bad, Betsy. I hurt so bad. Go get the doc. Go get the doc.' So I ran and got the doctor."
"Dr. Gleason?" Her eyes faded a bit, and she seemed confused, and then said,
"I don't think Dr. Gleason. I don't think we went to Dr. Gleason then. We went to him later."
"Do you remember the doctor?"
"I did, but then you said Gleason, and that got me sidetracked. I can't remember."
She did remember about manure spreaders and the funny things that might happen with them, about canning tomatoes and how everything changed when freezers came in. She remembered playing the piano with her sister and her sister's wedding to Bill Judd.
"Christ Lutheran Church. I was maid of honor. All the maids wore yellow and carried bouquets of yellow roses. But Bill Judd, he was a bad man. He was even bad when he was a boy. He used to steal, and then he'd lie about it and get other children in trouble. You know what he'd steal?"
"No, I don't," Virgil said.
"Money. He wasn't like other children who might steal somebody's toy or candy or something. You'd have him to your house, and he'd always be looking around for loose change. My mother used to keep a sharp eye on him after she figured it out. He was bad right from the beginning."
Tears trickled down her cheeks, and she said,
"After my sister died, there was all kinds of trouble. Bill didn't care about anything then. She used to hold him back, but after she died, nothing could hold him back."
She began to weep, and a nurse stepped toward them with a question on her face. "Are you okay?" Virgil asked.
"Bill did bad things. Bad things," she said.
Her eyes cleared a bit, and she said,
"Men are no damn good."
"I don't want to get you upset," Virgil said, "but I'm trying to figure out who might have started hating Bill Judd back then, and Russell Gleason." The nurse asked, "Everything okay?" Virgil said, "She's a little upset. She's late for her nap," the nurse said. Carlson looked at Virgil and said,
"Russell Gleason was there for the man in the moon."
That was the thing. The man in the moon.
Bill did a terrible thing, and we all knew. Russell knew, too. So did Jerry. Jerry knew about it.
"Who's Jerry?"
She broke into choking sobs, and her whole body trembled. The nurse said, "I think you should stop talking to her. This is not good."
You're really messing her up is what you're doing," the nurse said.
To Carlson, she said, "It's okay, Betsy. The man is going away. It's okay. Let's get a Milky Way and then get a nap. Let's get you a Milky Way."
"Not the Milky Way," Carlson said to Virgil, ignoring the nurse. "It was the man in the moon. And he's here. The man in the moon is here. I've seen him."
She began sobbing again, and the nurse glared at Virgil and said, "Take a hike." Virgil nodded, tried one last time. "Betsy, do you know the name of the man in the moon?" She looked up and asked,
"What? Who are you?"
On the way out, Virgil stopped and asked the woman at the front desk if they required anybody to sign in.
"Nope, not yet. That's probably next."
"Do you remember anybody visiting Betsy Carlson?"
"You know, I think I do, but I couldn't tell you who it was or even what he looked like. I just remember that she had a visitor because it was so unusual. This must have been, years ago."
"I'm looking into a murder over in Blue Stem," Virgil said. "A guy named Bill Judd, who was Betsy's brother-in-law. Do you know if Judd was paying for her care?" The woman shook her head.
"You should ask Dr. Burke that. But as I understand it, just between you and me, Betsy inherited some property from her parents, and when she was admitted here, it was put in trust. I think that's all she's got."
Chapter 7 Worthington was 30 miles east of Blue Stem, another node on I-90. On the way, Virgil dialed Joan Carson's cell number. Wherever she was out of range, so he left a message. "This is Virgil. Gonna be back around 6, I hope, if you've got time for a bite. Like to see you tonight. Thought we got off to a pretty good start. Anyway, let me know." He should have sent flowers, he thought. In Worthington, he stopped at a coffee shop, got out his laptop, bought a cup of coffee, signed on to the internet, and brought up a map. The town was twice as big as Blue Stem, but it still only took a minute to orient himself and pick out Evening Street. He took the coffee out to the car and rolled over to the west side, cut Evening, guessed left, guessed correctly, and spotted Michelle Garber's house. A post-war Cape Cod painted pale yellow, with green shutters on the windows, and two dormers above the front door. A flat-roofed one-car garage had been attached later to the left side of the house, giving it a lopsided look, but better lopsided in a Minnesota winter than no garage at all. Garber, Margaret Lehman had said, was divorced. And yes, Virgil could use Margaret's name when he introduced himself. Garber's house felt empty. Virgil parked in front, knocked on the door, got no answer, and looked at his watch. Hoped she wasn't in France. The house next door had a bicycle parked off the front step, so he went there, knocked. A sleepy teenaged boy came to the door, scratching his ribs.
"Yeah?
Hi. Do you know if Ms. Garber next door? Is she around? I mean, there's nobody home, but she's not on vacation?
Nah, she teaches summer school."
The kid turned, leaned back into his house, apparently looking at a clock, turned back and said,
"She ought to be coming down the sidewalk in 10 or 20 minutes. She walks."
Virgil went back to the truck, brought up the computer to see if he might link into an open network somewhere. Got nothing. Fished his camera bag out of the back and started working through the Nikon handbook. The damn things were computers with lenses, but the ability to take decent photographs was a selling point with his articles. An even bigger selling point would have been drawings or paintings. Painted illustrations were hot with the Tonier hook and bullet rags. He'd taken a course in botanical illustration in college and had thought about signing up for art classes in Mankato, thinking he might learn something valuable. Even if he didn't, he'd get to look at naked women a couple of times a week. His mind drifted off the Nikon handbook to Joan Carson. That could turn into something, even if it didn't last long. He was getting himself a little flustered when he saw Garber turn the corner at the end of the street. She wore black pants and a white blouse with a round collar and carried a canvas shoulder bag. With short dark hair and narrow shoulders, she didn't look like an orgy queen.
Hell, Virgil asked himself out loud, what's an orgy queen look like?
Garber was looking at him as she came down the street, and he put the camera on the floor of the passenger side of the truck and got out to meet her.
Ms. Garber? I'm Virgil Flowers. I'm an investigator with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I need to speak with you for a few moments.
She stopped in the middle of the sidewalk.
About what?
About Bill Judd. You've probably heard that he died in a fire a couple of days ago.
I heard that, she said.
We believe he was murdered, Virgil said. And because of a couple of other murders,
the Gleasons.
Yes. Because of those, we're beginning to wonder if the genesis of the whole situation might lie in Judd's past, Virgil said. They're all older people, so we're checking with old friends of Judd. She looked at him for a moment, the sharp, skeptical eyes of a sparrow, then asked,
Where'd you get my name?
Margaret Lehman.
She said I could use her name.
Garber showed an unhappy smile, then said,
Well, you better come in. Would you like some coffee? All I've got is instant.
Virgil declined. I just had a big cup, and I've been sitting in my truck. In fact, if I could use your bathroom for a moment?
Cop trick, Virgil thought as he stood in the bathroom. He didn't really need to go that bad, but once somebody let you pee in her bathroom, she'll talk to you.
They sat in the living room, dim light behind linen-colored drapes, Virgil on the couch, Garber in an easy chair that faced the television. She looked at him a bit sideways and said,
If you got here through Margaret, I guess you know about us running around with Bill.
Yeah, she was, pretty specific, Virgil said. I'm not taking notes on it, the specifics. I don't want anybody to get hurt. But I've got to know if anything happened back then that might surface all this time later. Violence, sexual activity, blackmail, money, power issues, something that could go underground for years and pop up later. It'd have to be something corrosive, something that involved both Judd and the Gleasons.
How many names did she give you? Garber asked.
Only yours, but she said she knew one more. She wouldn't give it to me, because she said if I asked questions, I could break up a marriage.
You just let it go?
She asked. Well, unfortunately, we're not allowed to torture witnesses. Yet, Virgil said. She nodded and said, Listen, I don't usually have coffee when I get back from school. I usually have a glass of wine. Would you like a glass?
I know, you're on duty.
The heck with duty, Virgil said. I'd like a glass. Garber went out in the kitchen and rattled around for a moment, then came back with two wine glasses and a half-full bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. She pulled out a rubber vacuum stop, poured a glass for Virgil, and the rest of the bottle in her own glass.
I can think of one thing, that's all, Garber said as she went through the pouring ritual. Bill started tearing around the country after his wife died, though there were stories that he used to go up to Minneapolis, even when she was alive, and buy sex.
So, what's the one thing? Virgil took a sip of the wine, which was so mild as to be almost tasteless.
Abortion, Garber said.
Abortion?
It didn't come in until, when, the 70s?
Bill's wife must have died sometime in the early 60s. I think that's right, she said. Anyway, he wasn't a big one for condoms or prophylactics, as we called them back then. It wasn't so easy to get abortions around here. There were stories that Russell Gleason helped some people out, including Bill.
Huh.
I don't exactly see how that would lead to murder. I mean, we're talking about the absence of a person, a child, not a presence. Unless the anti-abortion folks got to someone who's been sitting there brooding about it all these years, thinking about her lost child, Garber said. Maybe she got pushed into it by Judd. Maybe Gleason did it. Maybe she's just been sitting out on a farm somewhere, no kids, thinking about the one she aborted.
Virgil sat back. Maybe you ought to be a cop.
That's the best idea I've heard.
Well, if it's something that goes way back, she said, If my father had known some of the things I got up to, he might have done something about it. At the time, anyway. But we're all older now. The girls that hung out with Bill, our parents most are gone or too old to do something like murder. She took a hefty gulp of the wine, in a quick, hungry way that made Virgil think she might have a problem with alcohol. Margaret told me that there were sometimes group encounters at the Judd place, Virgil said, chasing around for the right word. Encounters, say, as opposed to gang-fucking. She said she didn't know the people involved because she went one-on-one with Judd. Could you tell me if these group get-togethers, if there were any other males involved other than Judd? Particularly married younger males? I mean, did he bring in any couples, as opposed to just single women? I'm thinking somebody who might be looking back at that time, feeling abused, feeling badly used. She looked at Virgil for a moment and then said, "If you get into the details of the whole thing, it sounds bad. But you know, at the time, it just seemed kind of exciting and dirty, but in a good way. I get almost sick to my stomach on the way over there, but couldn't wait to get there. So there were guys. One guy, at least. Barry Johnson. He was there a lot." She took another gulp of the wine, nearly finishing it. "He was the postmaster in Blue Stem. You never would have thought of it, to see him in the post office. Bill got him appointed to the job, through the congressman." "Were he and Judd involved in a homosexual way?" "Oh, no, no, no. Most of the time there were just two women and the two guys, and we'd lay around and drink, and sometimes somebody would have some marijuana, but that was about it," she said. "Sometimes there were three women, and us women would, you know, do things with each other, and the guys liked to watch, but they didn't do anything gay with each other." "Where's Johnson now?" She cocked her head and said, "I ought to know that, but I don't." Finished the wine and said, "I think he left here sometime in the middle '80s. This was when Bill was getting older and the whole scene at his place was over. I heard that Barry went to California or maybe Florida. Maybe somebody at the Blue Stem post office could tell you." Again she said, "Excuse me for another minute." She went back into the kitchen, rattled around some more, and then after a moment of silence, Virgil heard a faint pop. A moment later, she returned with another bottle of the Sauvignon Blanc and poured herself another glass. "Here's a question for you," she said. "What could possibly have happened back then? Think of the worst possible thing that would have brought Barry back here to kill people. And something else, how could Barry even get around town without being seen? Hundreds of people there know him by sight. And him coming back, everybody'd be talking about it. He'd have to be an invisible man if he's doing this." Virgil nodded. "That's a point, but the main thing is we don't really know what it might be. What if he and Judd had done something really ugly? Killed somebody? But Bill was going to die anyway. Soon. Probably weeks. Why wait all this time and then come back and kill him?" She shook her head. "You know, it doesn't sound to me like a cover-up. It sounds to me like revenge. And it's revenge by somebody you don't see because everybody can see him. You know what I mean? He's just an everyday guy. He's there all the time, so nobody notices him." She gave him the names of three more women involved with Judd. Two of them no longer lived in the area. One had moved to St. Paul, and the other had gone north to Fargo. The third one lived in Blue Stem, but was divorced and had gone very fat. "I can't see her managing to kill anyone. She can hardly walk a block." "Huh. Let me ask this. Have you ever heard of a character called the Man in the Moon?" She looked puzzled and shook her head. "No? Who's that?" "I don't know. But I'd like to." They talked a few more minutes, and then Virgil said, "Is that it?" She took a third glass of wine, was half drunk, and wasn't putting the bottle back in the refrigerator. "Are you working with Jim Stryker?" "Yes, I am." She eyed him for a moment and then said, "I heard one time, long time ago, that his mother Laura might have been sleeping with Bill Judd, and this would have been after she was married. Mark Stryker, Jim's father, was one of those odd guys that you could push around, and people did. I'm not saying there's anything to it, but when Mark killed himself, there were rumors that it was more than losing some land, that he found out that Laura was sleeping with Bill and wasn't planning to stop. Is that right? That's what I heard. I don't know how the Gleasons would fit into that. Anyway, her eyes slid toward the bottle. Thank you. You've been a help, Virgil said, standing up. If I could go back to those days... Her voice trailed away. Yeah? I'd do it in a minute, she said. Virgil realized that she was seriously loaded. I'd jump right back in that pile. That was the most fun I ever had in my whole damn life. A bleak realization for a 50-ish schoolteacher, Virgil thought on his way back to Bluestem. Would it lead to something? A commune for elderly rockers on the West Coast? Hitting on a high school jock? More alcohol? He picked up Joan Carson at her house and took her to the McDonald's for dinner. Big Macs, fries, shakes, and fried pies, and she said, I can feel the cholesterol coagulating in my heart. I'm going to drop dead in the parking lot. But she didn't stop eating. That's good for you, Virgil said, shoving more fries into his face. Eat this until you're 40, and then nothing but vegetables for the rest of your life. Makes for a short evening, though, she said. I was hoping you'd take me out to the farm, Virgil said. She looked at him. What for? You know, to see what you do. She shrugged. Okay with me. You know anything about farms? Worked on one up in Marshall, Virgil said. One of the big corporate places owned by Hostess. Harvest time I'd be out picking ding-dongs and ho-hos. We didn't do Twinkies. Those were mostly up along the Red River. We'd box them up, ship them off to the 7-Elevens. Hard work, but honest. I used the money to buy BBs so I could feed my family. Most of the local workers have been pushed out by illegals now. She eyed him for 10 seconds and then said, You do have a remarkable capacity for bullshit. The Stryker farmstead was an archaeological dig in waiting, a crumbling homestead, a woodlot full of abandoned farm machinery and a couple of wrecked cars, a windmill without a prop. The farm was built a quarter mile off a gravel road in a grove of cottonwoods at the base of a steep hill. Red rock outcrops stuck out of the hill, while below it, all around the farm buildings, all the way to Bluestem, and really all the way to Kansas City, was nothing but the darkest of black dirt, a sea of corn, beans, and wheat. Among the wrecked buildings, the barn was the exception, and was still substantial. Don't have animals in it, but we keep it up for the machinery, Joan said. One of the neighbors, you can't see his place, he's a mile down the way, rents out the loft, sticks his extra hay up there. The house, 100 feet across a muddy parking circle from the barn, was little more than a shed. Originally one of the plain, upright, porchless, clabbered farmhouses built on the plains in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, with a coal and wood-burning furnace and a hand pump in the backyard, it had been converted to a farm office and lounge. The second level, never fully heated, had been blocked off with insulation and plywood to eliminate heat loss in the winter, Joan said. The utilities had been moved out of the basement to the old back bedroom, and the basement was nothing more than a hole with some rotting shelves holding empty canning jars. Probably could get $20 each for those jars on eBay, Joan said. Why don't you? I don't need $400. The first floor had a barely functioning kitchen with a countertop hot plate, a microwave, and a sink with a table and 6 chairs. An electric pump fed the sink. 2 ruined couches occupied the living room, with mud circles on the floor where the farmhands had tracked through. An aging computer sat on a table in the former dining room, with a Hewlett-Packard printer next to it, and a couple of 4-drawer file cabinets pushed against the lath and plaster wall. After the roads got better, it never made much sense to actually live out here, Joan said, as she showed him through the place. Everything had to be brought out, and you were living out here in isolation.
Most of the time, if you didn't have animals, there wasn't much to do. In the winter, you did maintenance. In the summer, you'd do some spraying and mowing, but basically you were watching the corn grow, or the wheat, or the beans. By the time I was a kid, we had all that Star Wars machinery. A farm wife could sit up on a deer in an air-conditioned cab with a cassette deck and listen to rock and roll and do the harvest by herself. 90% of it was pushing buttons and pulling levers. No need for a house. I mean, it wasn't that simple, but it almost was. "So you moved to town," Virgil said. "Well, look around," she said, waving at the horizon. "If you look right over there, you can see one other house, but nobody lives in it. It's lonely as hell out here." "And Dad killed himself right out back, which still gives me the creeps if I'm out here on a winter night." "Nice now, though," Virgil said. The sun was slanting down toward the horizon, and a few wispy clouds streaked the pale blue sky. There was just enough breeze to stir the leaves on an endless ocean of corn. "Come on," she said. "I'll show you why the house is so far from the road. We have to hurry before it gets too dark. Bring your camera." Virgil got the Nikon out of the truck with a long image-stabilized zoom and tagged along past the end of the barn and the rotten timbers of what might once have been a hog pen, past an old pear tree and a couple of apples, angling downhill to a creek. A footpath, maintained by feet, led along the banks of the creek up toward the hillside. As they got closer, Virgil could see that the creek came out of a crack in the hill, feeding into a broad, shallow stock tank. Overflow from the tank fed the creek. "This is about as much water as we ever get," she said. "We're a little drier here than farther east. Come on." She led him straight into the crack in the hillside, a narrow, rocky cleft that widened to 20 feet, slightly climbing, with the water pounding downhill. The spray caught him a couple of times, a cooling sprinkle on the face and hands. "Keep coming." At the top of the canyon, 200 yards into the hillside, was a natural rock pool 50 or 60 feet across, fed from a spring that fell down the back wall of the canyon. A few small trees struggled to stay alive in the thin dirt, and cattails rimmed what must have been a muddier flat on the far side. "Cool," Virgil said. "Called the Stryker Dell on the geological surveys," she said. "Us kids used to come up here and swim. It's good in the evenings when the sun's coming down the canyon. It's a little gloomy in morning and cold." Virgil stepped down to the water, stuck his hand in. Cool, but not frigid, and he said so. "Because the water's trickling down that rock in the sunshine," Joan said. "This spring will go mostly dry in the fall. It'll just be a stain on the rock. The pond never goes dry because it's too deep, 20 feet right below our feet. But sometimes no water runs out of it. There used to be a pipe up here that'd feed the stock tank down below. Anyway, it's why the farm was here. Year-round water without much work, just by siphoning. If it wasn't for this, my great-grandfather probably would have built out by the road." Virgil took a picture of her standing on a rock on the edge of the pond, said, "Must have been a great place to come when you were a kid." "It was. If only there had been more people around, it would have been perfect." They sat on the rock in the sunshine, and Virgil showed her how the Nikon worked. A red-winged blackbird showed up and did some stunts on the cattails, and he took a couple of shots. They compared small-town childhoods and chatted about college years, dope-smoking and rock and roll, the price of corn, ethanol, about their parents. "My mom lives one street over and one block down from me," she said. "By now she knows about your trying to fill me up last night." "Only teenagers get filled up," Virgil said. "I was expressing a physical affection." "Huh. Seemed like getting filled up," she said. "I'd like to dedicate some time to do it right," Virgil said. "But this Gleason case, Judd..." So they talked about the case, and he worked the conversation around. "So your mom and dad were good friends with Judd? You think your mom would know something that went on back then? It's got to be something. Who the hell is the man in the moon?" "Maybe if we took my mom over to see Betsy Carlson, she could find out," Joan said. "We could do that," Virgil said. "Think she'd go along?" "If they let you back in. They might not be too happy to see you,"
if you had Betsy all freaked out when you left. She stood up and brushed off her seat and yawned.
We ought to get back before dark. I got my payroll to put together for tomorrow.
He left her at her house in town after spending another 2 minutes on her porch. She offered him a cup of coffee, but he had some online research to do, and she had her payroll.
Will you have time tomorrow night? Virgil asked.
Maybe we could run up to Marshall, go to a place that has candles and wine.
I'd like that.
Call your mom, Virgil said. Ask if she could run over to Sioux Falls to see Betsy.
Yeah.
She looked out at the coming night, the houses with big backyards, a kid's voice not too far away, laughing, and the first of the lightning bugs.
What a great night, she said.
If it were July in Minnesota all the time, you'd have to put up fences to keep people out. Virgil wrote a little more fiction that night and invented characters named Joan and Jim Stryker, and himself, whom he called Homer. Homer was terrifically good-looking and certainly well-hung, which might possibly come up later in the story. He smiled in the glow of the computer screen, thinking about it. Had to be funny, however he put it. He wrote, Homer felt as though he were being pointed at the Strikers. But if the Strikers had been involved in the murders, why would they call in Homer? They had to know about Homer's clearance record on murders. If Jim Stryker remained in charge, he might take a risk of losing an election. But that was better than Dong 30 years in Bayport, Max. The abortion thing was out there. And abortion would be a major matter for Fur, of course. Godless commie feminists with their coat hangers, gong after our virgins. Would it be possible that some local disciple of George Fur had killed the Gleasons, and then somehow, in the Fur's group's dealings with Bill Judd, let it slip? Had said something that led Judd to an inference, or even an accusation? If so, how would Homer ever find that person, given the lack of direct evidence? Homer lay on his bed, his hands behind his head, all four pillows thrown to the floor, and wondered about the man in the moon, and who Jerry was. Jerry had been there for the man in the moon, and about the sex. Given the fact that the ex-postmaster wasn't creeping around town, was it possible that one of the other sex partners had slipped over the edge? Again, it could be a religious thing, inspired by Fur. Anna Gleason. What had she been Dong all those years ago? Sleeping with Fur? They were of the same age. Goddamn laptop keyboard kept missing an I when he typed doing or going, which then came out Dong and Gong. Could be an embarrassing typo if it happened in the wrong place. He shut it down, went to bed, spent his 2 minutes thinking about God, and another 10 seconds thinking about dongs and gongs, and finding a new keyboard in a small town, and then fell fast asleep. Chapter 8 Mooney lay back with a little weed, in a little weed, out in the backyard, and blew smoke at the sky and watched the Big Dipper rolling around under the glow of the Milky Way, and considered the question. The number of necessary killings was growing. There was no emotional problem there, but the risk had increased. Mooney recognized risk. Two of the remaining killings, Jerry Johnstone and Roman Schmidt, were matters of honor, simple as that. They were essential and inescapable, and had already been delayed too long. If not done now, the targets might escape forever. Mooney blew some more smoke at the sky. Once the honor killings were done, and the reality had soaked in, the completion of his task, the pleasure of the memories, there'd be time to rest. Sleep had never come easily. 4 good hours were hard to find, and after 30+ years of sleep deprivation, Mooney had built up a great crankiness. Or maybe insanity. Whatever. Made no difference. 2 more killings were business necessities. A third, that of Virgil Flowers, might become necessary because of the way Flowers was deliberately roiling the town. People were closing down, locking doors, talking from behind chains. Maybe,
Maybe, Mooney thought, the dope wasn't helping. The tactics of the killings had been fine, but the strategy now seemed wrong. Judd should have been last. Could have been last. Mooney had killed him simply because the urge had no longer been containable, and because the old man's brain had been going. No good killing him if he didn't know why he was dying. Not an easy thing to manage, multiple murder. So what about Flowers? Flowers would be purely business. He was too competent, a danger. Flowers also seemed to have a kind of karmic presence. He'd come into Bluestem in the middle of a thunderstorm, had virtually driven into the Judd killing. Then, instead of pushing, probing, demanding, investigating, he'd sort of bullshitted his way around town, not to put too fine a point on it, gone around talking to everybody, telling lies, telling stories, had even taken the clerk at the Holiday Inn into his confidence. And in bullshitting his way around town, he'd caused a disturbance. Waves from the disturbance were washing around the county. Instead of waiting for something official to be done, for cop cars and crime scene crews, people were asking questions. And some were looking backwards. Too soon for that. So the question Mooney was here to decide, after work, out in the backyard on a blanket, with a little help from some friendly smoke in the Milky Way, was whether to kill Flowers now, and then go on to Jerry Johnstone or Roman Schmidt, or do Johnstone and Schmidt, and only do Flowers if it was absolutely necessary. An attempt on Flowers would be huge. Hard to tell where he'd be at any given moment, which meant that the killing ground couldn't be scouted ahead of time. You couldn't simply follow him. If he didn't see it, somebody else would. Couldn't invite him over and do it. Somebody would know about the invitation. That was the trouble with a small town like Bluestem. There were eyes and ears everywhere. You couldn't hang out without people noticing, and worse, knowing who you were, and wondering why you were hanging out. Walk down the street and you could see the drapes moving, the eyes pressing out of the houses, following behind you, the dogs watching from behind fences.